What up? It's the Crossover Friday edition. I'm Howard Beck, senior writer for Sports Illustrated. Folks, it's been a strange NBA season, especially for the players themselves. We've had postponements and quarantines, daily testing, restrictions on their movement, where they can eat, who they can see, no fans in the arenas for most of the season until recently. And it's been nearly a year of this, going back to the bubble last summer, of course, and I don't need to tell you how stressful this pandemic has been for all of us. Everyone in the world has felt it, and players aren't immune. Coaches, referees, none of the folks you're watching in the NBA are immune to this, and it doesn't matter how much money that they make. Their mental health has been strained, not just by the pandemic, but by the George Floyd killing, Breonna Taylor, the social unrest, the social justice movement, everything that goes with it. Michelle Roberts, the executive director of the Players Association, recently said this: "We're playing with fire." Michelle gave that comment to my colleague Michael Pena for a story that ran this week on SI.com about mental health within the NBA, mostly focused on players. It's a fascinating piece. You hear firsthand stories from Aaron Gordon, Kevin Love, Jaylen Brown. Adam Silver spoke to Michael for the piece. It's a really important story, an important issue. I really encourage you to go read it, but I wanted to go further. So joining me today are two guests, Michael Pena, the author of that story, and who, of course, hosts the Open Floor podcast for SI, and along with him, Derek Anderson, Dr. Derek Anderson. He's a psychologist who works with the NBA Referees Association. He works for the Washington Wizards. He's been practicing for 20 years. He's worked with law enforcement, with military, Fortune 500 companies, NFL teams. He was also the lead clinical consultant to the NBA and active in helping them develop their mental health program. He was in the bubble as the psychologist, essentially, that the NBA had brought in for the bubble as a mental health resource for the majority of the bubble last summer for everybody, players, coaches, referees. So Derek Anderson has phenomenal insight from working up close with all these folks. Before we get to that discussion, a quick reminder: please subscribe, rate, and review us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Hit me on Twitter at Howard Beck. Always appreciate all your feedback. Okay, conversation with Michael Pena and Dr. Derek Anderson about mental health in the NBA. That's coming up, so stick around.
This is The Crossover, an NBA show hosted by Sports Illustrated's Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
It's a whole new level for you and me, Chris, this relationship.
Like and subscribe for the best weekly NBA content these two are capable of.
What does that mean?
Could be the best duo ever.
I don't see how you can beat that.
Here they are, Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
In 3, 2, 1. Now, pleased to be joined by my colleague Michael Pena and Dr. Derek Anderson. Guys, thank you for taking the time on a really important issue. I'm going to jump right in, Michael, with your story, which just, of course, was published this week. The headline of that story was a quote from Michelle Roberts, the executive director of the Players Association, and it was dramatic. She says, "We're playing with fire, not doing more." What did she mean by that? And do you think that things are as dire for mental health in the NBA right now as Michelle was alluding to at the time?
Well, you know, when I spoke to Michelle, it was, I believe, early February, and the players' union and the league were having constant negotiations back and forth about the health and safety protocols, and how many visitors could players have when they were in hotel rooms? Could they venture outside of hotel rooms? When they were on the road, when they were at home, who could visit them? How many tests would those visitors have to take before they saw them? The testing was still very strict for all players at the time. And, you know, I think that, of course, mental health is inextricable from the entire NBA and has been for the NBA's existence. The circumstances of this season were so unique for obvious reasons. And there were kind of two core pillars of the story that I was trying to kind of wrap around. And one was obviously the pandemic and those aforementioned health and safety protocols that induce isolation and they keep players from their families. And I think something that I learned actually while writing the story is that Michelle did not have specific data to back this up, but she said just anecdotally that half of all players do not live, that have families, do not live with their families, with their partners, with their children during a normal regular season. And so this was very abnormal in that, you know, you can't fly in your wife or your partner or your kids during the year this year because of the global pandemic and obvious protocols that were set up to kind of ensure physical safety for the players. You know, you're living, there's a lot of other things about the global pandemic that are just tough on anyone, really. A lot of loss, a lot of grief. There were players who lost family members, of course, and dealing with that during a season is very difficult. The other, very speaking very broadly, the other topic that came up that I wanted to address with a lot of the mental health professionals that I spoke to was, you know, we're in these aftermath of or still ongoing racial reckoning in this country and a social justice movement where, you know, 75% of players in the NBA are Black and they've dealt with systemic racism and oppression their entire lives. But right now they are kind of at the forefront of this movement that, you know, there's a lot of pressure that some players feel about, you know, speaking out, being as educated as possible when you do speak out, to say nothing of the effect of it all. And then there's, you know, watching videos of Black men and knowing Black women have been shot by the police and trying to process that while you're going out and playing basketball games. And this was something obviously that was affected in the bubble as well. And long before all of this, going back to, you know, Trayvon Martin, and there's just countless examples and names that are very triggering. And so I kind of wanted to look at the compounding traumas stacked on top of each other and just see what the weight was for players and what their perspective was. And that's kind of what I wanted to tackle before the season began when I set out to write the story. And it just seemed like a very arduous, very difficult situation for them. And it has been for many.
And I think, and Derek, I want to ask you about this, that, you know, people looked at last season, especially the bubble part of it. And I think that's where fans probably thought, oh, well, maybe that, and some were skeptical about how tough that was, right? They're on a resort, you know, all this stuff, minimizing it. But that was the most abnormal part visually because people could see that, okay, yes, they're sequestered. This season has felt semi-normal in some ways. And so I think maybe people kind of got this sense that, well, they should be fine. Players, coaches, referees. But obviously there's an ongoing burden here. So Derek, you know, you work with the Washington Wizards, you work with the Referees Association and with the refs. What has been your experience this season in particular in terms of gauging the mental health of these constituencies?
Well, so it's a bit different for the referees than it is for players in that referees are now more isolated in a strange way than they were in the bubble. In the bubble, while we were there, they had each other. And, you know, there wasn't the travel, there wasn't the relocating, there wasn't the uncertainty of scheduling and et cetera, et cetera. There was the separation from family, but as a group, the referees had each other for support. After the bubble, strangely enough, there was more isolation because they had to follow protocols, which kept them in their rooms, kept family from visiting. And they, you know, they really weren't allowed outside. They were almost quarantined. So there was almost more isolation after the bubble for the referees than there was within the bubble. And for players, it was a shortened season, off season for them between the bubble and the season starting again and adjusting to the rapid changes in their life. It was almost three life cycles within a calendar year for them. You know, the normal season, then the bubble season, and then the COVID season that was afterward. And those rapid changes and the disruption of their lives and the inability to kind of become stabilized, plus the continuing trauma of all of the existing social justice issues, the political climate, and the cumulative stress that they built up over the year, with worry about their families, worried about their own careers in many cases, and their own health. So there was a cumulative stress, and wrapped in all of that, many of these players had childhood trauma, and some of the social justice movement and some of the political, discord, and even the separation from family kind of reignited some of those traumas. They were almost re-traumatized with a lot of micro traumas throughout the year and never really had time to process that, those feelings. They went right back into playing and right back into refereeing. And so I think what you're seeing is a group of people who have really been exposed to a lot of dynamic change, just like all of us, and had pre-existing stressors, et cetera, from their careers. And many of them, a lot of issues that they may have just been dealing with or hadn't dealt with that were kind of exacerbated by the situations. Now, mind you, I say all of that when I also will preface that by saying the players in the NBA and the referees are some of the most resilient people and adaptive people you'll ever meet. I'm surprised and always gratified to see how emotionally and mentally, to reuse the phrase, resilient they are and strong they are. They couldn't be in the places they are without being that. But having said all of that, there's still a lot of stressors that they've had to overcome and continue to deal with.
And obviously, you know, there are confidentiality things that would govern all of this. So I'm very much not asking for anything specific to a person, sure. But maybe Derek, maybe just in the broad strokes, can you give me a sense of like whether it's been a referee or a player or someone else that you have worked with in the course of the last year, when things are manifesting at the most intense level for somebody, what is it like? How is it manifesting? What are the I guess worst cases that you've seen in terms of like, to have people said, you know what, that's it. I got to walk away. I can't live this way right now. This isolation, being cut off from family, has it been more of just, I'm not motivated to go do the job tonight. How serious has it gotten for individuals?
Well, in fairness to them, I haven't heard anything that I didn't say myself. And I'm not saying this in a kidding way, that I didn't say myself while I was in the bubble or going through this season, where there were times where I said, I have to get out of this bubble. I can't be separated from my family. I don't want to do this anymore, the work that I'm doing. And I've been doing it for almost 30 years and I love it. And so I'm certain that there were many cases of players and others, you name it, all walks of life who said those things, where their stresses and their anxieties manifested in a way where they wanted to kind of like divorce themselves of what they perceived to be the catalyst for all of that stress. And certainly there were many times in the bubble I had to reach out to friends of mine who were professionals who I had to talk through that with. And that was my purpose in the bubble, for other people who were feeling that way to come and talk to me. And one of the reasons why things went so well, why I developed relationships after the bubble and strengthened ones that I had prior to it, is because I could really identify with a lot of what they were feeling, the anxieties and stressors. So I'm certain there were plenty of players who thought that, and plenty of coaches and staff members and everybody who felt that. It was a lot to handle. A lot, and it continues to be. But I think, like I said, the resiliency of the people that I've worked with has been astounding, and they rebounded from those feelings and sought help in many cases, and found ways to connect to the people within that sphere and outside of that sphere in novel ways to kind of re-energize themselves. I saw a lot more healthy behavior there than I expected, to be honest with you.
Michael, in your reporting And of course, you know, neither the league nor the union's ever going to quantify these things. I'm not sure if they're quantifiable, but did you get any sense of how, you know, how widespread these struggles are for players over the course of this season? You know, it from the outside, it always looks so simple, right? We're watching the games. It looks almost normal, right? They're playing, you know, they win, they lose, you know, you see the same emotions outwardly. There's this weird veneer of normalcy in watching the NBA this season. You know, okay, yeah, we don't hear fans. We don't see fans for a lot of the season, but everything else seems kind of normal. Do you have a sense of just how many players or percentages of teams that have had to along the way, you know, grapple with this in a way that they wouldn't be in normal times?
Yeah, you know, that was a big crux of trying to report this piece, to get specifics, to get data to inform my reporting and to inform exactly what the problems are. But of course, privacy is such an important factor here, an important element in mental health treatment and in the allocation of mental health resources, that it was very difficult. Broadly speaking, you know, I spoke to several team psychologists who didn't make the final cut of the story, who would not speak about specific players or specific instances, but said, you know, in their years working with NBA players and working with NBA teams, that there was definitely a growth in players reaching out and needing those resources that have become available in the past few years, whether it be, you know, actually engaging in individual therapy with a therapist or a licensed psychologist or psychiatrist, or, you know, just wanting to engage with a different type of coping mechanism that maybe they didn't try before, and learning about meditation or learning a breathing exercise or anything like that. And Derek brought up, you know, referees, and this also didn't make my story, but when I spoke with Kevin Love, you know, he told me multiple times this season that referees would come up to him and say, hey, you know, I'm really going through something right now. This season is very difficult on me. I need help. I need to know, you know, who do I reach out to? How do I get help? Who do you speak to? Do the Cavs provide a therapist for you? Do you have your own? Just how did that all come about? So I thought that all of that was very fascinating. And honestly, I said this the other day to Dr. William Parham, but every interview that I did for the story could have been its own story. And wrapping everything together was, you know, I hope I didn't shortchange anything. But, you know, every story is very powerful, and there's so many different anecdotes that I came across. But that was one of the more powerful ones. Also, just, you know, Kevin saying he was frankly surprised that referees were going through something, because they aren't in the spotlight as much as a player would be, and they don't have necessarily the type of platform that they can speak out about something that they're feeling, and they have to hold things in a different way than NBA players do. So I thought that was all very, very interesting.
Yeah, Derek, you know, this obviously, you know, right back to your wheelhouse with the referees there, that, you know, I think the NBA has made great strides over the years in making sure that there are certain resources available to players, and in the mental health realm specifically. I don't know, prior to the last year or so, how much the referees were getting this, whether through the league or through their own association, the National Basketball Referees Association. Are they maybe grappling with it even more so than the players? Because at least for the players, it has maybe become more normalized or part of the infrastructure of teams. Whereas I honestly don't know how much the referees were given those resources directly before.
Yeah. Well, I was the league's clinical resource for several years, 5-6 years prior to this year. And I interacted with a lot of players and a lot of staff and not many referees. So, I really didn't develop a relationship with the referees until I was in the bubble with them and got to know them. And I started thinking about it. I was listening to Michael, and they're different stressors. They don't have necessarily the celebrity that players have. but they're certainly in the spotlight during a game and sometimes after a game. And it's never, I wouldn't say never, but rarely is it in a positive way. I mean, they're often villainized during a game. And if you know about a referee, it's not because of the call that you liked, it's because of the call you didn't like. And so they have to absorb a lot of toxicity from every aspect of their career, you know, whether it's on the court, from players or coaches who are in the moment and are heated and understandably, you know, sometimes feel vexed by calls, or from fans who are a bit vociferous and a little, you know, eager to express their disdain for a call. They have to absorb that and remain professional while they travel, while they work out, while they fine tune their craft. And so really when I was speaking with them, and not even clinically, but I did some presentations in the bubble with them. But when I was speaking with them on a more personal level, it occurred to me that the resources of mental health, even though the league does provide for them, that, you know, they could really use a shot in the arm as far as a personal touch when it comes to mental health resources. And they're a very tight-knit group, a very healthy group in the way that they think and speak and handle the stress, but it is a great deal of stress. So I was surprised at when I started to think about it and digest it, just how much they have to endure during a season.
And of course, even in the best of times, you know, a lot of things you describe about the you know, the situation the referees are in and the backlash that they take and all the stresses, like that's part of just the normal routine for them. And then you add all this other stuff for the last year on top of it. I'm wondering if you've seen, are more referees, do you think, seeking out, mental health advice than before because of everything the last year has brought? Are there, you know, more of them availing themselves now of it? And what has your general advice been? Maybe, you know, if you could give me maybe a little bit of a rundown too, of like, if you were doing your PowerPoint presentation to, you know, to the referees, I mean, what are the things that you're kind of advising this group on? Listen, here's what you're all dealing with. We all know these are very stressful, abnormal times. Without necessarily saying, you know, go see a therapist, here are the things just in your day-to-day that you can do to try to keep a balance.
Yeah, well, one of the big things I tell everybody is try not to make life-altering decisions in your most stressful times. So we sometimes do make big decisions to try to escape the stress, right? This job is what's creating stress. My relationship are creating stress. When your overall level of stress and anxiety is so elevated because of what you're enduring in your environment on a day-to-day basis, sometimes things that would normally be a 5 on a scale of 1 to 10 feel like a 10 to us. And we make decisions to extricate ourselves from situations that we find, toxic. So I say, try not to make your biggest decisions during your highest levels of stress. Understand that, there are things you can't control and things you can control, and be very, very cognizant of what it is that you can control and engage in some of the healthy behaviors that you probably have let go because you're tired or you're lonely or you're frustrated. We sometimes have a habit in our most stressed times of going to the things that comfort us, not necessarily the things that are healthy for us. That's why I gained 15 pounds during the pandemic, right? So I didn't gravitate towards exercise. I gravitated towards hamburgers. And so it was to soothe.
Totally justifiable, by the way. Totally justifiable. I'm defending that.
Right. Thank you. Because I may be starting a whole hamburger therapy session.
I'm in. Yeah. I'm in.
So we'll do that. So be aware of it. It doesn't necessarily mean you have to stop doing the things that make you feel good, but always recognize that feeling good and being healthy aren't necessarily the same things. So realize when you're lapsing into habits to feel better, but not do better. and also be acutely aware that the people you left behind are also dealing with stress, the stress of your absence, the stress of what's going on in our world and environments. And if you can be, if you can come outside of yourself and be helping of those or be there for those people, it sometimes makes what you're dealing with a little less painful and a little less severe, that you know that you're giving and listening to someone else who's also in need. And so being aware of other people's suffering was a big thing that I say can help, and so on and so forth. There are a lot of little mental health tips that you can, you know, that you can take to improve your life, but you have to be disciplined about it. That's the other big thing. It's one thing to hear it and to say that makes sense. And then it's another thing to be disciplined about doing it. It's no different than exercise. It makes sense. And you know, it feels good once you do it. It's not going to give you immediate results. It takes time and practice and discipline in order to be good at any of this stuff and to feel better.
Michael, in your reporting and all the conversations you've been having, like literally since I think you said before the season began, can you get any sense of how it's impacted the day-to-day? I mean, obviously the mental health of the players and others in the league is more important than anything that comes along, you know, with the basketball part of it, right? But the basketball part of it is what we are all in tune with. Do we believe that this has impacted the day-to-day, you know, there's the rhythms of the season, right? And injuries come into play, guys get in slumps, all the usual just basketball stuff. When we look at this season, and it's been a profoundly strange season in so many ways, do we think that maybe mental health and the challenges that guys have faced has actually been part of, just below the surface, maybe what's gone on with certain teams or certain players in the seasons they had?
Yeah, you know, there's so many different variables, obviously, that can impact mental health and vice versa, mental health impacting on-court performance, which was something that I did try to get to the bottom of, even though that is impossible. So yeah. That was tough. But, you know, speaking specifically on just a day-to-day, something that came up time and time again was the testing. And another thing I don't think that people really can put themselves in the shoe. I mean, getting tested is wonderful, obviously, and players were tested multiple times a day. But there's this inability to separate work from life for NBA players. So even when, you know, they're not quarantined or they're not isolated and they're not in a hotel room, the fact that they know that, hey, I have to wake up at, was supposed to be an off day, and would have been an off day, but I have to wake up early at 7 o'clock in the morning and drive to the practice facility and get tested. And work is just constantly on your mind, and you can't, speaking to players more generally, one of the things that they talk about when they relate to mental health is it allows me to get away from the game. Like Peyton Pritchard said, I like to live a double life. I'm a basketball player, and then I'm just like a kid. And other players said similar things to me. And the testing, and I'm going to reiterate, is important and was important to have the season and to keep people safe and to keep the players safe, but also their loved ones safe who they were around. But at the same time, it was just very difficult for you to kind of separate who I am as a person versus, okay, I am an NBA player 24/7 until my team is eliminated or the season ends. So I think that was a very specific thing that impacted day to day. But that was very difficult for a lot of players to deal with.
Yeah. It makes me think about Kyrie Irving. And I want to be careful about this because obviously I don't want to put you in an awkward position here, Derek, in particular, but I wanted to use Kyrie as the example of this. Kyrie takes some time off from the Nets. And because we are not informed as the public or as the media about the rationale for it, immediately there's a suspicion and this kind of snarky, cynical view of this among fans. You can see it on social media. We are still, unfortunately, even in the midst of the pandemic and everything, a fairly mean-spirited world at times in sports, I think. And there's no benefit of the doubt given. But it underscores, I think, just that, you know, we never know what anybody's going through, right? Even in the best of times, even in a normal season, a guy may need some time off. So Derek, without necessarily addressing Kyrie, because I know that's a stickier thing, but just in general, I mean, Are we all selling short that when a guy takes some time off for whatever unspecified reasons, that there are at any given time that there are probably something weighing on someone, that where basketball just and work does not become as big of a priority? How should, I guess the question would be, without us, you know, the three of us necessarily lecturing fans, but how should we treat these situations, given what we know players may or may not be going through, and given what we also don't know at the time that they may take some time off?
So that's a good question. Before I answer, Michael, you're 100% right. I had to test every day, and it did draw you back into, you never really fully decompressed while you were working with sports and with basketball players. All athletes, I try to tell them, and I've worked with first responders and military. I tell them, be sure this is what you do, but this doesn't define who you are, because a well-rounded person is a healthier person and able to withstand the difficulties that come with your occupation. So a great point that you made. And to answer your question, think about this. When you were young, well, when I was young, which was a longer time ago, when when I wasn't feeling well emotionally and I really just needed a break from school, no one would, and my mother's a loving person, she's a wonderful person, but if I said, Mom, I'm just not feeling it today, I don't want to be at school, there's nobody on earth at that time that would have said to me, well, stay home and, you know, watch some cartoons and I'll get you a peanut butter and jelly sandwich and everything will be fine. No, it's like, you got to go to school, you got to tough this out. And so we learn very early in our life that if we're broken, Mom, I'm sick, then I can stay home. But Mom, emotionally, I just need some space. Then you go to school. So we all have been socialized to see that that ask of, can I have some space, personal space, as something that's, why would I give that to you? But if I say I'm physically broken, or even if I seem emotionally or psychologically broken, and rather than just saying I need some mental health time and space, people will, I'll back off. So you'll sometimes see people use anger as a way of giving themselves space, or depression as a way of giving themselves space. I'm not saying it may be conscious, but it's a way of doing that. So the brokenness of it is how we try to focus in on mental health, or the ask of time to heal. And really, I mean, I don't know Kyrie or his situation, but let's say it's me and I take time off. Immediately, people want to give me the label of being somebody who's broken, or someone who's manipulating the system, rather than saying, wow, that's a healthy thing he's doing, because he's asking for time to heal himself or recuperate emotionally and psychologically. So we're socialized to think that way and to be almost unforgiving of people who ask that.
Yeah. No, I think you're absolutely right. And the way you say it, Derek, it actually just, like, it really hits hard. Like, it feels like we all have this responsibility jointly to kind of change that that discussion. And I don't think we all do a very good job of that. And we in media, Michael and I now, you know, we and our brother are all guilty of this on some level, that I think that's a lot of it. I mean, I think to the extent that fans might be cruel about this, maybe we are not conveying this as best as we can as the media, because it is, no benefit of the doubt is given. No, you know, it's a very harsh reception that guys get if they say they just need this time off, which leads me to this point. So it's been 4 years since Kevin Love and DeMar DeRozan kind of, I don't want to say it was like, you know, breaking down some barrier. It's not that others in the NBA hadn't talked about mental health before, but that was a moment. Kevin Love and DeMar DeRozan being very open about their own struggles in 2017 was a moment. And we all refer to that now as a flashpoint, and that the NBA is more engaged on it now. But there's a quote from Robbie Sicca, who's the vice president of basketball performance for the Timberwolves, a quote from Robbie in your story, Michael, where he says, I think mental health prior to the pandemic was something that was one of the things that we didn't really openly discuss unless there was a crisis. It was something that we talked about when we found out there was a player who was depressed. was a very reactionary thing. Now we're talking about it as a proactive thing. So I want to ask both of you, from Derek, from being on the inside of this and being active in this area as a professional, Michael, from your reporting, I'd like to be optimistic and think that, okay, the NBA has now used all that experience to push this forward and be more proactive about it and be more engaged. But I'm a journalist and I'm cynical about these things. And I wonder, like, you know, is the league doing enough? Is, you know, where do things stand now? Is it far beyond where it was in 2017 when Love and DeRozan first came forward?
Yeah, I'll go first if that's okay, Derek. You know, real quick, I just want to say that going back to what you guys were talking about earlier about certain, you know, not knowing what players are going through. You know, I had this conversation with Bismack Biyombo, and he was talking to me about, you know, as he was coming up as a basketball player coming from the Democratic Republic of Congo, and he had six younger siblings. He felt the need to be a role model for them at all times. He felt the need to quash tears when they would come to his eyes. And he is a former teammate of DeMar DeRozan's. And, you know, told me that he had absolutely no idea that DeMar was going through anything. He thought he was just a great guy, happy-go-lucky, wonderful teammate, one of his better friends on the team, and was frankly stunned when DeMar tweeted about feeling depressed, and then the ball kind of got rolling from there. But, you know, to speak to the integration and the difficulty of integrating mental health and mental health resources into the 30 NBA organizations, I think that that is still very much in the early stages, for sure. And some teams have been better at it, I think, than others. And it's such a tricky issue because, again, privacy and confidentiality are, and trust and honesty are so critical here. And, you know, teams at the end of the day are billion-dollar businesses that are trying to win. And that is kind of a little bit of a crux there, and not everyone's motivations might be aligned. But, you know, the Minnesota Timberwolves, I spoke to their team psychologist, Dr. Justin Anderson, and I honestly don't remember if this was in the final story because it went through so many rounds of edits, and Howard, you can probably understand. But, you know, he talked to me about, you know, this year, like, I was playing Madden with Anthony Edwards. And, like, it wasn't even, like, you don't call it a therapy session. It's just, I'm a therapist, and I'm going to play Madden with you and talk to you and see how you're doing with your day-to-day and how you're dealing with this NBA season. And I can't say that every NBA team has or use their psychologist and their licensed clinical mental health clinician to do something like that. But I do think that it is, we're at the early stages, I would say, in all of this. And I think that, you know, sometimes it's not even up to the team necessarily to provide it is up to the team to provide the resources, but players still have other options. As Adam Silver said, there's no monopoly on this, from the union, the league, the teams. Players can independently go out and seek, it's just speaking about individual therapy if they would like, through their insurance, or they're all very wealthy and they can pay for a therapy. So I think that it's still evolving, just from the sense that I got, and there's still a lot more work that needs to be done.
Derek, where would you say things are? How much progress has been made in the NBA on these issues in the last few years? And have you played Madden with any of the referees recently?
No, I haven't played with any player or referee. Well, I'll tell you, the league, I remember contacting the league. I was working for the Mets at the time, and we were at the 2015 World Series, and I called the league and I said, I'm a psychologist and I want to help. And within 2 days I was sitting in the league offices. They were eager. They recognized there was a need, and I was there immediately and started to work. And so I know that, and I don't work for them anymore, so I don't have to, to ingratiate myself, but I know that they're dedicated to it. And we spent many years trying to figure out the best way to do this. The team that I left behind there are really dedicated to making mental health a something that's accessible and integrated into the culture of the NBA, both at the team level and the staff and the referee level. So I believe the NBA has its heart in the right place and are putting resources towards it. Having said that, Michael is completely right. There's one thing to draw this out on paper. The diagram of what this should look like is very clear, it seems. We'll put a psychologist in a team. The players will say, oh my goodness, here's a resource. Let me use this. Here's my private office. I'll take that 1 hour, talk about all of the things and unburden myself and become a better person and a better player. And then the psychologist will have, you know, his hours will be filled and we'll all understand his role and there'll be confidentiality and respect for that space. And it doesn't look like that. You have to sit down and play Madden with a player. Because you're in their environment, you're in their space, and you have to meet them where they're at. And so the institutions of psychology have to alter themselves a bit when they get into those places, keeping at the foundation confidentiality and trust. Without that, you're dead in the water. And, you know, if you go see a psychologist, you're going there with trust already in hand. Like, this is going to be my psychologist. I'm going to trust them with my problems, whatever. When I go into a locker room, I have to earn trust. And that takes a year, 2 years. You know, the transient nature of basketball or any sport. I've worked for all four professional sports. You're constantly rebuilding it. You feel the pressure of having to justify the money that you're making, whatever that may be. But at the same time, holding true to what you do as a psychologist. And so you don't want to be in the face of a player. Hey, you feeling okay today? You feeling okay today? A player will push you away for that. So you have to be quiet and subtle, yet available, and earning trust, but not being too ingratiating. It's a delicate balance. And I think psychologists throughout the league, I get calls from colleagues in all sports. Thankfully, because I've done it for a while, but they'll call me and say, Derek, how do I do this? Like, this is hard, you know, like who is my real client in this situation sometimes? Who, you know, how do I maintain these boundaries when I'm getting pushed and pulled in certain ways? And how do I get players to be more receptive to what I have and to offer? And it's going to take time. Resources don't necessarily mean that they're going to be automatically appreciated and used. We're fighting against a history of people being taught that things like psychology aren't necessarily for that culture, for the African-American culture, for male culture, and for the athlete culture. So it's layered. And if you think about the history of Black people and things like psychology, those were used as almost tools to incarcerate them or to alienate them or to disenfranchise them. You know, you're crazy, go to jail. It wasn't used as a tool to help the African-American community. So for us to expect that it'll immediately be embraced by Black athletes and white athletes for that matter, because emotional weakness that's what they see this as. And you're a weak link on the team if you're a baby, if you're a sissy and you can't play. I mean, you know, that's some of the derogatory stuff I've heard players called earlier. I don't hear that much anymore. And so this is what we're battling against. And I implore the leagues and the teams to continue what they're doing and not panic because it doesn't look the way you think it should look. It's going to take time to really take root and for it to be worked out so that players trust it and utilize it in a healthy way.
Yeah, I guess the quicker way of saying it would be if only it were as easy as just sitting down for a couple games of Madden, right?
I know that I can drone on a bit. I'm sorry,
but no. I just mean that as like no, these are complicated issues, and it is obviously a long and arduous process to change all of our understandings, and the framework that we all grew up with. So no, I don't, mm-hmm. I didn't mean that as a quip about your explanation. It's more just, if only it were as easy as having the team psychologist sit down and play Madden with Anthony Edwards. By the way, do we know who won those games, Michael?
I do not know who won those games. You know, confidentiality is obviously a huge thing here. So
yeah, does that fall under client privilege, Derek? Who?
Yeah, probably. And all that. Don't ask me anymore anything about psychology. Go to
all right, so let me end on
one last thing. We have nutritionists all around us, and that doesn't mean that necessarily people go for the healthier meal, right? Like, the resources are there.
Yeah.
What difference does that make, right? Like, sometimes there's books all around it, and yet sometimes I go and watch television.
No. And the nutrition one is a great analogy, because we probably know more today than we ever have in the history of humankind about what's good for you, what's bad for you, whatever. And we're all still, like, you know, buying the bag of Doritos. So let me end on this one, because this is very, very relevant to this. Michael, you write in the story that, I'm quoting directly, even though the war between non-acceptance and normalization has dramatically shifted toward the latter since 2018, there are still ways mental health remains a complicated subject. Most teams contacted for this story declined interview requests for relevant members of their organization, as did dozens of players who were invited separately to offer their perspective on the topic. Now, neither you nor I would give short shrift to the fact that obviously these are sensitive issues, so it's somewhat understandable. But it does also speak to the fact that institutionally and individually, there's still a reticence to discuss this. You know, even in the abstract, even a team official who doesn't have to talk about their own experience, it would just be about how they're dealing with it on behalf of their team. Like, that there's that much reticence, I think, tells us something.
100%. I mean, Howard, when I set out to write the story, I didn't anticipate people, like, you know, blowing up my phone to want to talk to me necessarily. But I also was a little, frankly, surprised at the organizations that we're going to pass on this. And there were a lot. I understand why players wouldn't maybe not be comfortable speaking, and that's totally understandable. But I was a little caught off guard from the organizational perspective, especially after speaking with people from the league and speaking with people from the union about just the abundance of resources and the importance, the collective understanding. You know, Derek mentioned earlier, I totally agree that there is a 100% commitment to have this at the forefront from the league office, from Adam Silver on down. Absolutely. I just think that it's really, I think there's still a stigma for sure. And then there's also this difficulty in not wanting to get it wrong from the organization side, is the sense that I got. And again, you kind of, you know, you just mentioned nutritionists or even like a strength and conditioning coach. And one psychologist told me, you know, when he was watching The Last Dance and watching all those players from the late 80s and early 90s who are really skinny compared to the guys today, and just how the implementation of nutrition, of sleep, of weight training has changed bodies and changed approaches for players. And this is something that we're very much in the early stages of, and the effect of trying to help the players is just, we're early. And I think that the integration process is still kind of touch and go and trial by error right now.
So let me wrap up on this note, and we can keep it brief, but I want to steal from Kevin Love, who at the end of your story, Michael, basically asked the question, you know, what's next on this front? So for each of you, Michael, I'll ask you first, what's next?
I mean, I think more of the same in terms of keeping the resources available. I think that, you know, I'll bring up a quote that Michelle Roberts said. I don't have it in front of me, so I'll just paraphrase. But, you know, speaking about where society is with regards to the stigma of mental health, and society accepting this, I think, goes a long way towards even young players being more willing to seek help and seek treatment instead of thinking that they can do everything on their own, which is what a lot of young players and older players think. And that is the mentality as an athlete. Hey, I am resilient. I'm basically a miracle to get to the NBA doing it my way. And who is to say that I cannot continue on and beat this thing, be it anxiety, be it depression, whatever it may be. So I think that's a very slow process, honestly. And acceptance of mental health. I mean, even just getting the reactions to my story now, like there is still such a large segment of society that looks at professional basketball players and the money they make and, hey, what do these dudes have to worry about? And it's just like, it's really, it's sad and a little bit discouraging, but these things do take time. And I think that the NBA and the union and many teams are on the right path towards really integrating mental health resources in an effective way.
Derek, what's next?
Well, to touch on what Michael said, yeah, I mean, I was in locker rooms in the 90s, the early 2000s, and I do see changes, but they are glacial in the way that they move. But I do see differences both in organizations and players, that the ones coming out of college have been exposed to sports psychology and psychology at a much earlier way, in a much more healthy way. I think what's next is shifting the conversation from mental illness to mental wellness within the league, making the talk about mental health not about what's not working, but what is working, so that the players find the topic more palatable and less frightening and less stigmatizing. If we can start shifting that, you're never going to change. Michael hit on something else. By the way, Michael, I got to read this article because the points you're making are right on, and I appreciate that. But money, when fans look at this and they hear you making $10 million, $40 million, $100 million, like, why do I have to listen to you whine about your problem? What kind of problem could you possibly have? And there's not one of us that doesn't have a person in our life, or maybe that person in our life, where you think he or she has the world at their feet, and yet they're still sad, they're still depressed, they're still anxious. What you have materially has really no impact on how you feel emotionally, because the pursuit of happiness is where money comes from, but happiness is not necessarily the pursuit of health. If I'm healthy, I'm in a position to be happy, but if I'm searching for happiness, I'm not necessarily in a healthy place. So stop looking at what they make, stop looking at what they have, and think about the fact that they're 20-some and 30-some-year-old men who are in a high-pressure situation, who may not come from the best place, and are doing the best that they can. And as far as referees are concerned, these are people who are really trying to do something great with their careers and have really worked really hard and really have to suffer the toxic blowback of all kinds of people absorb that and remain professional. Just think about what these people endure for a bit, walk a mile in their tennis shoes, and know that where we can go forward is for our fans and for people who are casual observers to educate ourselves on mental health and mental wellness. And that'll make it easier for the players and referees to get the help they need.
Amen to all of that. And that's something that I think we all need to consider more day to day, as fans, as media, as consumers of the NBA or sports. Guys, this has been great. Derek, Michael, thank you both. Folks, if you haven't read it already, go to SI.com and look up Michael's story. The headline is "We're Playing with Fire: The Mental Peril of This NBA Season." It's really great stuff. Go check that out. Guys, again, thank you so much for spending the time on an important issue. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Eric.
Thank you.